Today on Against the Grain, nothing sounds more wholesome than kids and sports. But as legal scholar Dion Kohler illustrates, youth sports have become increasingly commercial, unregulated, and competitive, with companies, including private equity firms, replacing publicly subsidized recreational programs. This highly lucrative industry profits from, among other things, clubs, camps, equipment, mega facilities, and youth sports tourism, exacting a high cost from families and an even greater physical and mental expense from children. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. In a society where children are increasingly sedentary and where recess and physical education in schools is limited, youth sports would seem like an antidote, allowing kids to move and play and to be together. But as Dion Kohler shows in More Than Play, How Law, Policy, and Politics Shape American Youth Sport, the reality is much more complicated. She's professor of law and director of the Center for Sport and the Law at the University of Baltimore. Youth sports, Dion, are widely seen as a positive endeavor for kids and really for society more broadly, allowing young people to get physical exercise, to bond with other kids, and to play. What is the darker side of youth sports that's missing from this warm, fuzzy picture?
I think there are several things missing from this picture. I think the primary thing is children's reality to a large extent. A lot of what we have with youth sports in terms of our policy choices, in terms of how cases that are about youth sport injuries, for instance, a lot of these things are built on assumptions. The assumption that youth sport, as you say, is sort of a uniformly positive experience. It's a good that every child should have. The reality is a much more complex picture. And so for many children, our current youth sport model, for lack of a better word, prices them out. It's just too expensive. So we have a whole group of children who can't even access youth sports. And then we have the children who can and who get involved in youth sports. And for the most part, and of course there are some regional and local differences, but for the most part, we have a system that is so highly commercialized and professionalized that we're treating children in youth sports like they're mini adults, like they're mini professional athletes. We put them on the fast track, we're training them to win, they're traveling all over the place. And so it's expensive, it keeps a lot of kids out. And then for the kids who are in it, what we know from the data is that most of them quit by the time they're teenagers because they're either burned out, they're injured, or the toll on the family from the expenses and all the travel just gets to be too much.
Well, let me ask you a bit more about that. You mentioned that children are pushed into specializing in one particular sport at the expense of everything else. Can you talk about how that pressure comes about and the consequences for children?
Yeah, so today's youth sport model, and again, generalizing, I'm sure there are great programs, and we know there are great programs all over the country. But for the most part, what the model emphasizes is get a kid into sports and get them good at that one sport as early as possible. And it squeezes out the opportunity to play other sports, to try other sports, because the demands on the child's time are so much. You very quickly get into a situation where the number of practices and games and the travel gets to be such that a child can only, in fact, play one sport. And I know I was the parent of two athletes. I was an athlete myself. And what the schedule became was punishing to the point where, you know, my son had other interests, but travel hockey takes over to the point where, you know, we were spending Thanksgivings at tournaments. So the system sort of pressures parents kind of indirectly, really, to keep going and keep putting their kids into more things and more camps and more personal coaching. And so pretty soon the child's time is very quickly taken up and there's only time for one sport.
Well, I want to ask you more about the component of the parents, but before we do that, how did the shift happen from youth sports being done through often publicly subsidized programs, often available to low-income kids, kids of color, and the expensive world now of private youth sports clubs? Over what period of time did that happen? How did that happen?
It really happened over the last 30 years. So private youth sports programs have been around since the turn of the 20th century, since the progressive era, where at that time it was youth sports were pitched as a way to get young boys, to keep them off the streets, to ensure they didn't turn into delinquents, to make sure they turned into good American citizens with good ethics of, you know, hard work and character. So from that point, we get to the last 30 years, which is this is where the shift becomes really strong. And in the last 30 years, there are political ideas that take hold that really trickled down to youth sports. One of those ideas was privatization, right? We have government doing less and less. This idea that government should not provide as many services as maybe they have since the progressive era, but we should privatize. And so we have a rise of private youth sport providers and a decline in public rec leagues, right? So the privatization idea takes hold. In addition, you have the rest of the sports industry, certainly over the last 30 years, at all levels, Olympic sport, college sport, professional sport, the development is such that it becomes really, really big business. And the United States leads the world in the sports industry from that perspective. So as higher levels of sport become more commercialized and industry takes over there, it naturally trickled down to children's sports. And then the third thing is that over the last 30 years, this idea developed as well, a sort of political idea or assumption that I write about in the book and some of my other work, which is that the government shouldn't touch sports, that sports are this magic space and it would ruin it if we regulated, if we stepped in, if we had any requirements or minimum safety standards or anything like that. And so we see the government sort of pull back and say, not only are we not going to provide sports opportunities, but we're going to try and stay away from even giving a baseline level of regulation of the experience.
Did this shift that you've described that intensified over the last 30 years, even though this is not the focus of your work, was it parallel with a change to the amount of sports that is available for children in schools?
Well, it does in the sense that, you know, sport has been available in schools for a very, very long time. But what we know is since Title IX was enacted in the 1970s, that is the statute that prohibited gender discrimination in education-based programs generally. And so after Title IX is passed, it quickly becomes applied to school-based sports programs. And then Title IX itself, of course, sort of in popular culture, stands for this idea of women's equality and equality for girls and opening up spaces and experiences for girls where they haven't been able to, you know, get involved. And so as Title IX gets rolled out as applied to education-based sports programs through the 70s, 80s, and 90s, what we have again is this explosion of participants in youth sport because now we're finally providing opportunities for girls. So that's a good thing that we've opened up sports for girls. But what it also means is that commercially, youth sports are more popular than ever and there's more money to be made because we simply have more participants now that we let girls in the game.
Well, this is a very broad question, but what's generated from youth sports materially, even, you know, politically, ideologically, as you write, it's a multi-billion dollar industry. Who benefits from it?
So one of the things I spent a lot of time on in the book is I really wanted to do a sort of, as I call it, a distributional analysis. You know, who benefits, who burdens from the way we do youth sport today. And it's clear that the youth sport industry makes just a lot of money, a lot of revenue from it. And that number is growing even more. Now we have private equity investment in youth sports. But the youth sport industry is everything from sort of providing the experience, you know, sign up for this or that soccer program or volleyball program. Then there are the private coaches and the trainers. There are, of course, equipment. But a big part of it as well is this notion of youth sport tourism, which I discovered in researching for the book. And this is the idea of building these youth sport mega facilities, especially in underused areas, and attracting tournaments, attracting youth sport travel teams to come and, say, spend a weekend at a baseball tournament or whatever. There are also these sort of week-long camps. And so the youth sport industry itself kind of grew up all around. There's everything from, you know, personal coaching dollars that can be made to special apps for tracking everything from kids training to schedules to youth sport tourism. And I talk about all the other beneficiaries as well, right? Higher levels of sport. The way we train kids today, we've got plenty of elite athletes. We have too few spots for them to compete, for instance, in college. And I talk about the benefit to parents as well. Parents, we often talk about in youth sports, are, of course, burdened by the cost. They're burdened by the time on families. And research shows it's a significant amount of time that families spend on youth sport activities. But parents get a big benefit and a boost as well. They love to see their kids perform. These become family experiences. Parents build social lives around youth sports. So the picture is a complex one. And what I ultimately come to in the book is it's not easy to see where the clear benefits are for kids of doing youth sport this way versus a less professionalized way.
What you've just been describing sounds, of course, incredibly expensive. People traveling to these places to have their children compete, paying for coaches, traveling all over the place to have their children compete with other teams. In the past, it appeared that the ranks of adult athletes were populated with people who came from working class backgrounds or poor backgrounds, including, of course, many athletes of color. Has the shift that you've been describing, the privatization of youth sports, the movement of youth sports out of kind of publicly subsidized endeavors to these private clubs and all the infrastructure around them, changed who athletes, adult athletes are?
Well, I think it hasn't changed it as much as it has just continued to foreclose options for kids. So we know that sports that are very popular in schools, like football, like basketball, those are always going to be options. Those are very, very popular, for instance, with children of color, children who are less socioeconomically privileged. So the school sports always kind of offer an option. But too often, what we see is that in order to make certain sports teams in high school take advantage of these publicly subsidized teams, a child would have to start in that private club system. And so what's happened is that certain sports definitely preference or privilege children who are already socioeconomically privileged, right? That are club sports. If you look at things like swimming and volleyball and certainly soccer, has been pay to play for a very long time. And so we look at certain sports and we look at the composition of teams at the, for instance, college level. And what we know is that a lot of teams really just benefit upper middle class and upper class white children who can pay to get the coaching and to have the access to these teams. And other children just can't.
Legal scholar Dionne Koller is my guest. We're talking about her book, More Than Play, How Law, Policy, and Politics Shape American Youth Sport. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you said a few minutes ago that it's hard to sort of really tease out the benefits to children, to young people, of this whole system of youth sport. We can see the benefits of it for all sorts of different players, but not so clearly the kids themselves. And I wondered if you could talk more about that and both the sort of injuries that kids can have playing youth sports and also the ways that it may affect them less visibly, mentally.
Yeah, so one of the things that interested me when I was writing the book is that I discovered that we make a lot of claims about youth sports and how incredibly beneficial it is for kids. And I think many of us, I participated in youth sports, many of us who did participate in sports feel that these claims are true. And I think it's not that they're false, but I think what we know is that there isn't a lot of good research to say that this model for sports, with kids training and traveling and having all these professionalization elements, this model produces the types of benefits that we tout when we tout youth sports. So the research that we have shows sort of obviously that exercise and physical play are very good for kids. We know that that's something that's important for everybody, is to get exercise and to be moving their bodies. But we provide then we make the leap by saying, okay, because exercise and physical play are good for kids, that we should be providing this highly professionalized youth sports system. The solid research that we do have, though, on youth sports is we have a lot of research about downsides. So entities like the American Academy of Pediatrics, for instance, has been publishing papers, sports medicine physicians publishing papers about overuse injuries, overtraining injuries. For instance, even in youth sport baseball, we now know kids' arms were being way overworked. So there's a lot of medical research about the harms of overtraining. We also know from the research, and the American Academy of Pediatrics has done some work here as well, there can be, in fact, quite a mental strain, a tremendous amount of pressure on kids, especially where their parents are sort of working with coaches and pressuring kids to keep playing and playing at a high level. So we have a lot of research actually about the negatives of this type of approach to youth sport. We do not have a lot of good research that says this approach to youth sport is what delivers the types of benefits that we hope a youth sport experience will deliver.
You mentioned play, and in your book, More Than Play, you make a distinction between sports and play. Historically, children would engage in, I guess, what we could call athletic play informally, through, you know, living in a neighborhood, meeting up with other kids, playing pickup games, and so on. And much of that seems to be getting replaced, or has been replaced, by this much more regimented, intensive, adult organized versus kid organized kind of sports. There are a lot of speculation about why that kind of play has become less common. How do you understand it and the relationship of the rise of this kind of private competitive sports industry in its place?
Well, I think there are many, many reasons why this has taken place, and sociologists have talked about this shift from free play time that kids have to this overscheduled time, and how the notion of being a good parent is getting your kids into scheduled activities with measurable results, right? You know your kid is achieving benchmarks, and you know you're a good parent because your kid performs for you on the weekend and they're getting better at their sport. So sociologists have had a lot to say about the decline of free play. What I talk about in the book is that this decline in free play has been replaced, of course, by market forces. The market is stepping in and providing parents with a youth sport experience. Parents can buy this experience, and it buys them several things. I mean, first of all, as we all know, anybody who's raised children Childcare, for instance, is a challenge. And so parents who want their children to be, instead of home alone or left to their own devices for free play in an activity with some level of oversight, well, you can put them in soccer, right? So on the one hand, there's a sort of, I need to keep my kid occupied. But on the other hand, there's also, sociologists have talked about, there's a feedback loop. There's a benefit to parents where, again, if the message is youth sports are good for kids, you feel like a good parent because you are putting your kids in as many youth sport programs as you can. And in fact, I reviewed in the book, for instance, various government documents that promote youth sports. You know, there's something called the National Youth Sports Strategy out of the Department of Health and Human Services several years ago. And the message is loud and clear. It's parents, put your kids in sports and keep them there. Don't let them quit because sports are good for them. So I think the market has answered the call, which is we will provide youth sport experiences. We will charge plenty for it. But what has happened then is that we're not really having policy conversations about what youth sports should be. We're sort of leaving it to private providers. And from the perspective of private providers, it's kind of a more is more analysis. I mean, if you read media reports about private equity investment in youth sports, what you read over and over again is that private equity investors love youth sports because parents will pay anything. They will keep paying when it comes to their children's sports because they believe that it is good for their kids. They believe it will pay off in the future. And let's face it, most parents like to see their kids perform on the weekends.
Right. And it also seems to tap into a broader anxiety amongst parents that, you know, their children are going to go into a world of more heightened competition on every level. And so all these anxieties about getting them into the right preschool and, you know, getting them ready for university when they're in kindergarten and all of that. But yet what's interesting, of course, is that it doesn't speak to sort of less parental involvement because, of course, we know a lot of people are working very long hours because parents are actually sacrificing a lot of their time, their leisure time, to drive children around on the weekends to see them perform. So it seems kind of complicated. The pull of it is obviously very strong, especially for upper middle class parents.
Yes, it's both a pull and it's a tremendous drain on the family system in terms of hours, in terms of dollars, in terms of mental energy. So it's both. It's both sort of restorative for parents, rejuvenating, and exhausting.
Well, let's talk more about how parents have played a role in the privatization, hyper-competition, intensity of youth sports over the last 30 years. Some parents are obviously very, very invested in having their children compete, having their children succeed. What kind of ways does this manifest itself, and what burden does that place on the children?
Yeah, so this is something that's been talked about in popular media for years and years, Sasha, and that's, you know, bad sports parents, right? Parents who just lose their minds in sports. And what was interesting, as I researched the book, I found in the psychology literature, there's a whole psychology to this. And it's so easy. And I actually saw it myself when I was a youth hockey parent, when my son was playing, and my daughter was a gymnast. Perfectly reasonable people can get very drawn in to the point where they lose their objectivity, they lose their sort of parental stance, and they get sort of pulled in with their child into this experience. And they quickly find themselves saying and doing things that they wouldn't normally say or do. They sort of, you know, the psychology of it becomes so intense for some parents, for sure. And I know the feeling on a small level, because certainly when I was watching my own kids, I would find myself saying, you know, go get that puck, you know, sort of saying to myself, or, you know, stick that beam routine, right? And I quickly said to myself, my God, I'm really getting pulled into this. And I was able to center myself, but I certainly saw many parents who really couldn't, who would yell at their children to do better and be better. And these were people that are good, reasonable people, And in the moment, they sort of lost their head and their composure. And so this is a well-known problem in youth sports. And I think we've had national conversations about the bad youth sport parent. But I think that we also need to give some grace to youth sport parents in the sense that we've set up a system where we're telling parents, your kid needs to be a competitor. You need to be a parent that supports this kid in being a competitor. And so it's very easy, and we know from the psychological literature, to sort of lose one's head in those circumstances. In terms of how it plays out for kids, I think the research is unequivocal, which is it's not good for kids. It's not good for kids to be yelled at by their parents. I know I never yelled at my son playing hockey, but it was a real moment for me to see other parents yelling at my son as he played hockey if he missed a puck. And so again, good people that can sort of lose their composure and behave in ways they wouldn't normally do. And so we know that, it's documented, it's well known. There's a sort of youth sport parenting literature from a psychological standpoint, and it's a continuum. You know, you can be sort of mildly invested and kind of excited, understandably, that your kid is doing well, all the way to the other extreme where you see your child as a meal ticket. And of course, we've all seen highly publicized, stories about that as well. So I think we know about these issues, but what we never do is kind of have the underlying conversation, Sasha, which is how do we change the underlying system so that parents aren't so drawn in, right? You have parents spending a lot of money, a lot of time, all the things we just talked about, and then they get to the sidelines and yeah, they want to see a payoff. I think we need to have the underlying conversation about why we've built a system that seems to sort of encourage parents to not be always at their best. But we also need to keep in mind that the research is quite clear that this is a negative for kids. And this is what we were talking about at the outset of the interview. When we talk about how youth sports is this unequivocal good, this is such a great experience for kids, we often leave out the fact that it can quickly become a negative experience when parents become too involved and when parents and coaches are just putting way too much pressure on kids.
And as I think you're alluding to, if we just look at the parent part of this story, we're missing some key structural issues around the way that the government has allowed youth sports to, the structure of youth sports to be regulated or not regulated a certain way, and the market stepping in this intense commercialization of youth sports, which brings me to then ask you about the government. You know, I think there's an assumption that a lot of parents have that, like with actually many products and other things, where there's an assumption that the government is regulating safety, when in fact that may not be the case. What does that look like for youth sports?
Well, I think one thing we need to do is, as parents, people that put their kids into youth sports, there's all different, you know, sort of overall political biases and you know, we lean this way or that way, red and blue. I think we need to step away from those labels and those ideas, and we need to take a look at kind of what we've always assumed about kids in this country from a law and policy standpoint, and what by and large we have done for children with respect to law and policy outside of youth sports. So if we see youth sports as a product or a service for kids, what we know, and again, this goes way back to the progressive era, is that we've kind of had a consensus in the United States, and you know, different people are on different extremes, but that kids are not yet fully formed in the sense that they're still growing, they're vulnerable, they need protection. And so we have lots of laws out there that are set up to protect them. We set a limit for when they can buy alcohol. We ensure that cribs and car seats are safe that we put our babies into. We ensure that kids, put a helmet on when they ride a bicycle, right? We don't leave things to chance because we know that if we just left it, for instance, to the kids, they might not make the right choice, and the consequences could be forever, could be sort of irreparable. Similarly, there are ways where we have said, that we don't want parents to have the full authority to make the choice because they might have a self-interest, and child labor laws are a great example of this. No, we have made a collective choice. We don't want 9 and 10 year olds sort of laboring and sort of out of the house, earning wages to help the family's bottom line. What we would like to do, and again, we've made these choices since the progressive era, is we want kids in school because that can best preserve their future choices. We haven't done much of that in youth sports, in the sense that youth sports, at least some youth sports, can present a pretty significant risk of pretty serious injuries, right? If you look at sports like ice hockey or tackle football, lots of sports, soccer with repeated heading, right? If you look at some sports, now sports are great for kids, and I'm not here to scare people and say that sports are dangerous for kids. I don't mean that at all. But if we look across the range of sports that we offer to kids and how we have kids playing what are really adult games, you know, we don't adopt that protective stance. We don't adopt a stance that, for instance, people who are coaching kids uniformly need to have a background check to make sure they don't have a criminal record or to make sure they haven't been involved in abusing children, etc. You know, we have sort of a spotty patchwork. Some states do a little of this, some states do a little of that. Most states do not much of anything. And so I think that's where parents get a little bit confused, because when something goes wrong in youth sports and when there is a serious injury and they want to, say, go bring a tort lawsuit, for the most part, parents aren't fully successful. And they say, wait, wasn't somebody regulating this? Wasn't somebody making sure that the coach knew what he was doing, or, you know, didn't have a background as a sexual abuser or whatever? And so the answer is, by and large, we don't. We leave it to parents to protect the safety of children in youth sports. And that is markedly different than some other areas that touch kids' bodies and minds.
Well, which brings us to the question then of the legal rights of children. What legal rights do the children have in this case, which may not be the same as what their parents want for them?
Yeah, children have almost no rights in this situation. This is really a space, youth sports is a space that is really characterized by parental authority. So the law very strongly gives parents the right to determine how they will raise their children, and for good reason. I certainly did not want to have my children saying, I have a right, you know, not to eat vegetables. So there are reasons why the law, of course, gives parents so much authority here. And so what that means for kids in youth sports is parents are the ones to decide to put a child into youth sports, to keep a child there to the extent you can keep a child doing anything that they don't want to do. But also, I talk about in the book, you have parents who can decide to delay kindergarten, to repeat eighth grade so that their son or daughter will be bigger or stronger for a future in youth sports, right? You can make lots of choices. Medical procedures that could strengthen a child's arm, say, if they're a pitcher. There's lots of things that parents get to choose for kids and have the authority to do. We do, in this country at least, think of children as just not mature enough to really have rights, many rights. And so there are certainly examples children have, for instance, in schools, some First Amendment rights or some rights to privacy under the Fourth Amendment. But for the most part, kids don't have a lot of rights, and certainly not in with respect to their youth sport experience. And so it's a very open-ended thing. Without a lot of regulation and protective regulation, the youth sport experience is left for parents and private providers to define.
And do you think that's the reason why there's such a high rate of children dropping out of youth sports at the beginning of adolescence, that they don't really have much leverage otherwise?
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons. I think what we know from the research is that a lot of kids drop out of youth sports by adolescence because of burnout, because it's just too much. They're exhausted. And of course, By the time they get to high school age, there are other demands on their time. They want to spend time, and they should spend time on friendships and in peer situations. And so youth sports is just, it's just too much, and they're exhausted. We know that they drop out because of injury, overuse injuries, and again, overtraining. So we know that kids are not responding favorably in the long term to this approach to youth sports, but the private equity and private industry has been able to just make so much, you know, sort of generate so much revenue off of the youth sport model that it's captured really with kids at younger ages. And then the few kids that do stay in youth sports, you know, they were the ones who sort of went through the system and learned, okay, I'm an athlete. And this is something that I've talked about a lot with respect to the book and with respect to youth sports. Not only does our model, is our model sort of set up, and research tells us this, as a way to sort of burn kids out ultimately through the overtraining, it's also a model that sends a message to kids. And by the time they're about 12, 13, they've gotten the message whether they are an athlete or not. And that's a mistake. A lot of people have talked about this from the perspective of, we've got a lot of kids who are late bloomers who could certainly benefit from a sports experience, from the exercise and the friendships and all the good things that we say about sports. But if we have a system where you're an athlete and you're not, and that's determined by the time you're 12, that's a lot of missed opportunities for kids. It's a lot of missed opportunities if you're self-interested and say, gosh, we want to have many more people vying for our Olympic teams or college spots. It's a missed opportunity. And so I think we need to look at that as well.
Legal scholar Dion Kohler joins me. We're discussing More Than Play, How Law, Policy, and Politics Shape American Youth Sport. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain. So, Dion, you were describing how the government does very little regulation of youth sports. And I wanted to ask you how that compares to sports in general in the United States. What is the government's role in regulating sports in terms of questions of things like safety?
On the one hand, our approach to youth sports, kind of the government keeping its hands off, that's very consistent with our approach to sports generally. On the other hand, if you look at other sports settings in which adults compete, there are many more laws of general applicability, not necessarily regulating that sport in general, but there are many other laws that apply that provide adults with protection. So if you look at professional sports, and this is something I talk about in the book, professional athletes have the benefit of labor law and employment law. They have unions. They have the opportunity to have unions kind of collectively bargain on their behalf. And one of the items that unions in professional sports collectively bargain over is things that could affect the safety of the game and a player's health. So, of course, youth sports couldn't have unions. It wouldn't work at that level. But kids don't have that benefit, right, of that entity that is charged with looking out for their benefit. If you look at Olympic and Paralympic sports, we have the Ted Stevens Olympic and Paralympic Sports Act, and there are different requirements in that act that apply to adults and kids who participate in national governing body affiliated sports, for instance, safe sport protections to try and protect the athlete from abuse. There's a patchwork of different things that are happening. High school sports, of course, anything happening in high schools, there are going to be various regulations there. So we have a patchwork of different things in different sports contexts. Youth sports really have the least law that applies directly to the experience when it is in a private setting.
Well, you've been stressing how youth sports not only are private and commercial, but also quite profitable. And I wondered if you could talk about the history of this model of the amateur athlete and the ideas that have bolstered that notion that in the broader society and then in youth sports, the idea that athletes must somehow exist in a pure realm outside the grubbiness of money making, except that those profits do go to someone, just not the athletes.
Yeah, so the idea of amateurism and the amateur athlete is a very old one. We sort of inherited it from the British upper classes that, had this idea of, athletes are people that do their sport for fun, for the love, for the joy of sport, and not for any commercial gain, right? Which was considered to be, considered to make games, sort of less pure. And so we inherited this idea, we kept this idea going. And if you look at the history of sports development in the United States, what we see is this idea took hold in two settings quite strongly. And of course, you may remember this growing up, Sasha, I don't know. I know I certainly do. The first setting is in Olympic sport. And there used to be all kinds of very tight rules and regulations that Olympic athletes could not earn any income in connection with their participation. Now, those of us who have watched Olympics know we've had many, many dream teams, as I talk about in the book, where we've used NBA players to play on behalf of Team USA. That's been quite commercially successful. It's been very successful from a medals standpoint. But there used to be this idea that the games, the Olympic Games, could only exist if the athletes got no compensation for their participation. Similarly, the second setting, of course, in which this notion of amateurism took hold is in college sports. And this idea of what the NCAA made up, which is a term called the student athlete. And it's based on this kind of romanticized notion that these individuals participating in sports, they do it for the love of their sport. They are students first, et cetera. Well, we've had decades of data, of research that show that, of course, college athletes, certainly in the big time programs, they have almost no time to go to class. And they are generating, again, tens and tens of billions of dollars that are flowing to lots of other people and not them. And the Supreme Court in 2021 came down with a ruling that the NCAA's model with respect to certain restraints on athletes violated antitrust law. So the notion of amateurism has been breaking down for a long time, because what we know certainly from the Olympic example is that fans are not bothered when athletes get paid and generate income in relation to their sport. What we know from the athlete experience is that they should, because actually to be an elite athlete today with the state of sports and where we have evolved to today, that is a full-time job. That is, your training, your conditioning, you are spending time on your sport, and it doesn't leave any time to earn an income another way. And so that's really what the college model bumped up against. That's what certainly the Olympic model bumped up against. And so we see a lot of changes happening at these higher levels of sport. But what has trickled down to youth sports is just this kind of romanticized, this rosy notion of amateurism as this pure space. I don't know that it ever was a pure space. I think what a lot of people have written about, certainly historians who have studied this, have said it was more a labor relations tool than anything inherent to sport itself. But certainly what we know is that youth sports as well, it needs to be looked at more closely and not left to develop on its own. Because as we've sort of ignored youth sports from the perspective of regulation, thinking, well, it's just amateur, what we know is actually the children are putting in some serious hours, some serious time, and there are some serious implications for their bodies and minds.
Well, then switching to what could be done about the situation, how might we think about how youth sports could be regulated? And on the one hand, there's the question of health and safety, protecting people from concussions, all of those questions about protecting the bodies of children. But is there another dimension in which things like, labor law might even come into play?
Well, I don't know that labor law would come into play here in the sense that, again, we still have children and we really wouldn't be able to unionize child athletes, and although they could certainly learn a lot of civics that way. But I think, first of all, we need to kind of move away from the idea that any level of regulation is, that regulation is a bad word, right? We know that there can be good examples of regulation and not so good examples of regulation. And so the first thing we need to do in terms of thinking about youth sports is have policy conversations and have them first and foremost at the state level. Youth sport is something that states can get involved in terms of both regulating the experience, making sure it's safe for kids, but also providing the opportunity. And so engage with our policymakers at the state level and say, we would like more, say, recreational youth sport activities. If you want alternatives, if the highly professionalized model doesn't work for your family and your child, then certainly let's have some policy conversations and talk to our states about making more room for publicly subsidized recreational youth sports. Interestingly, when I co-chaired the Commission on the State of the United States Olympics and Paralympics a few years ago, we did a tremendous amount of public opinion surveying all across the country. And subsidizing sport participation for kids, that's an easy issue. Our survey results showed people really thought that that was a good idea. That's investing in the future. That's giving kids the type of exercise and physical play that they need. And so that issue is something where we should be engaging. The second thing is that as we have policy conversations, certain sports played in certain ways, is it a safety risk for kids? Can we do more to make sure that coaches, for instance, have some sort of basic first aid training and other things? I know there are a lot of private youth sport providers that do these things. But do we want to set a baseline so that we know every kid in every kind of program is getting a minimally safe experience? So there's lots of space out there, Sasha, to think about ways that we can make youth sport better through both subsidizing recreational play to kind of regulating the safety of the experience. And it doesn't have to be this boogeyman that we often think of, which is, oh no, regulation is the government coming in and telling us all what to do.
Are there lessons that can be drawn from other countries and how they regulate sports and even the rights of children around sports?
Yeah, I think there are. There are, and one of the things I talk about in the book is the example that many people involved in youth sport talks about, which is Norway. Norway heavily subsidizes youth sport opportunities, limits the amount of competition that kids do before the age of 12, so that kids are really sort of playing and developing their physical literacy along the way before we sort of turn them into mini elite athletes, mini professional athletes. And so Norway does that, I think, very, very well, as good as anybody. And to the extent people are worried about adopting changes to the youth sports system, Norway's output in terms of gold medals, they sure do win a lot in the Winter Olympics. So, you know, if people are worried about whether we can still have kids that grow up to be athletes that win things, I think Norway says you certainly can do both. But what happens around the world, there's much greater conversation about children as humans that do have rights that we should be thinking about. There's something called the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child. One of those rights is a right to play. And that's really important. And I think a lot of countries sort of see that as a starting point to think about how can we do youth sports. We are the only nation in the world that is not signed on to the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child. But that document and what it stands for in terms of centering children, what do they need, what types of protections and rights would be most beneficial for kids. Outside of the United States, those are the conversations that youth sports often revolves around, these types of values. We don't have those conversations in the United States. That's typically not how we think of children here. And I think with respect to youth sports, we have some room to do that.
How do you see the relationship, I guess this is quite a broad question, between sports and politics, you know, for example, nationalism, and then youth sports in that? Does the ideas around the role that sports play in the larger society act as an obstacle for changing things like the lack of government regulation and the marketization of youth sports?
One thing that we all need to get over is this claim, and we see it repeated over and over and over again. I talk about it in the book, that what's great about sports is that it's not political. And, you know, it rises above politics. It's this area of just great equality, et cetera, et cetera. Well, that's just not true. There are so many reasons to love sports. I am a huge sports fan, but the idea that it's not political is not one of them. It's completely political. The way we approach sports, the way we decide whether we should regulate youth sports or not, those are political decisions all the way down. And so, all levels of sport are shaped by politics. We have had policy conversations, again, since the turn of the 20th century, where the political idea of the moment shapes how we think about youth sports. So it used to be that the government was promoting youth sport participation to make boys into good American citizens. Then as we got to the Cold War era, youth sport was touted as the answer for military readiness, then on and on. So as we have the rights revolution, it's youth sport is important for kids to learn important life lessons, and we need to open up these spaces to children of color. So our youth sport conversations always reflect the political ideas of the moment, whether we realize it or not. The way we have constructed youth sport and approached youth sport is political. Again, this notion of privatization being a really good idea, that's a political idea. I think we all need to realize that these are political choices. And I think once we do realize that sports, like any other sort of social phenomenon in society, that these experiences are political, it opens up space for us to say, wait, we do have a choice here. The model that we have for youth sport today is ultimately, at bottom, it's a political choice. It's a choice not to regulate, for instance. It's a choice not to publicly subsidize youth sports. And so once we realize that, this model is not some inevitability. It's not something sort of handed down on a tablet, you know, by Moses on high. It's just a political choice. It opens up space for us to realize we can change it. We can change it and make up sports however we want to. Because at the end of the day, sports are really just made up games, and we can make them up however we feel they best serve our kids.
Dionne Kohler, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dionne Kohler is the author of More Than Play, How Law, Policy, and Politics Shape American Youth Sport. She's professor of law and the director of the Center for Sport and Law at the University of Baltimore. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time.